All right, good morning. We're going from Cameron to Keith.
From the sublime to the ridiculous.
I think I'm going to ask the question I know everyone here is wondering, top question for you. Did you go to Barry's boot camp this morning?
I did not, actually. I saw Lucy, though, from who runs a company called Passes based in LA and Miami, was posting that she was there at 6 a.m., and I sort of missed it. But I will, before I fly out of here, go to Barry's today.
I think I saw on the Coastal website you average more than one per day. So does that mean you have to do
638 classes last year?
So you're going to have to make it up because you were here with us. So everyone should feel really honored, right?
We could just roll out the treadmills and weights.
There you go. We're here in LA. Do you spend a lot of time here?
I haven't historically.
What city would you spend more time in?
Well, Miami's actually a really interesting comparable city. It's got the blend of entertainment and pop culture with technology and influential people in all kinds of fields. So it has some common denominators, but I prefer Miami.
I didn't know that. Wow, I'm going to have to redo all my questions. Okay. obviously, you mentioned you're going to be in California and Miami this week. You were in San Francisco earlier this week for a board meeting. What's it like back at Coastal Ventures so far?
Well, you know, it's strange, but maybe everybody in this room kind of understands. The glacial pace of venture, the pace of venture is so glacial that I disappeared for 5 years. And then a month ago, I rejoined and I felt like I was dropping into the same conversations with the same companies, that nothing had changed. It literally felt like Groundhog Day. Maybe that's because the same four senior people were MDs. Maybe it's because companies do take 8 to 10 years to grow up. But the agenda was the same. It was really, really an interesting, arresting. Like when, you know, I also run a startup, and I've been involved in a lot of startups over the years. And if you dropped out of a startup and came back in the same company 5 years later, it would feel like you're on a different planet. It felt like I was in the same conference room with the same people doing the same things, talking about the same companies. It was really bizarre.
Is that a good sign or a bad sign for venture capital?
I don't know. I mean, the positive version is that it takes 8 to 12 years to build a company. So it's pretty natural that companies I had funded in 2013, 14, 15 were now growing up and they were topics of conversation about, you know, follow-on financings, et cetera, or exit opportunities. The negative version is that nothing changes in venture and, you know, in theory, things could be better in lots of different ways.
So obviously, I'm biased because I wrote an interview about your joining Coastal, but for those here who are not Forbes subscribers, shame on them.
Yep.
Can you maybe give us the short version of why you surprised the community by going to Founders Fund and then surprise them, perhaps even more, leaving Founders Fund?
Yeah, the FF thing in 2019 was pretty interesting. It's what one of my favorite people in technology called the six. I asked three people for advice in 2019 whether I should do this. And one of them said it's like one of these 60-40 decisions. Like it's not obviously better or not. They're fairly close cousins, actually, along the scale of all venture firms in the world. FF and KV are pretty similar in terms of high upside, high potential, disruptive founders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So pretty small delta there. There are some stylistic differences about how people do their work and fund strategy, which we could talk about, is pretty distinct, but closer cousins than farther apart. The real reason, actually, if you read my interview in 2019, which I didn't give to you as an exclusive, unfortunately, was mostly about commute. So we were at KV in 2019, the canonical Sand Hill venture firm. There was one office, and everybody met in the office all day Monday, partner meetings, you know, think your stereotypes from the 1970s and 80s. And then we were still in the office on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays. And I lived in San Francisco. And the companies at the time that were being built that I felt that were most interesting between 2013 and 2019 were not down in Palo Alto. That was frustrating to me. And I remember actually talking to Sam Altman and I said, like, is this crazy to change jobs on your commute distance? And he said, like, look, every study of human happiness that's ever been published says the number one variable is happiness is inversely correlated with your commute time. And Keith, you're still human, so it's perfectly fine to make a decision on that basis. So I actually did. Anyway, things changed. COVID, you know, unleashed lots of changes in venture particularly. I moved to Miami. KV now doesn't have just one office. It's not just a monolith. Everybody doesn't spend all day in Monday partner meetings. And so it was a lot easier to envision. We had a lot of success in my days at KV. I think the combination of the four MDs plus me actually in KV 4, 5, 6 had some really good investments across the board, across all of us. And so it was exciting to be able to work with the same people again. And actually get to learn new things. in FF, it's mostly about what you do with your work product, which is a perfectly normal way to run a venture firm. At KV, like, I don't know much about AI or haven't known much about AI or haven't like really mastered it. I get to sit and watch from at least two of my partners know a lot about AI and have been basically right where everybody else was wrong. And so every week I actually attend meetings I don't even need to because I'm getting like a free education. And I'll probably eventually make an AI-based investment based upon all this osmosis learning.
So would you say, you said the firms on the spectrum might be more similar than not, but is there a different stylistic approach to at least how the partners work together, how deals get done, that you know one was more comfortable to you than the other in the end?
I think there's input and output driven organizations. In technology, you can have actually success in both. Like think of famously Amazon, Apple are input driven organizations. Bezos used to talk about this all the time, why and why inputs are better than outputs to manage people. Google, arguably Meta, are output driven organizations. So you can obviously be successful with an input strategy or an output strategy. I tend to be an input-driven person. Like that's how I like to, like for example, the company I run is called Open Store in Miami. And one of our four core values is sweat the inputs. So for me, I'm probably happier in an input-driven environment. I had a debate with two very good founders yesterday that I'm on the board of a company in San Francisco or Tuesday about whether they should be switching a little bit more from output orientation and OKRs to inputs. Mm-hmm. So that's just a stylistic thing. And then secondly, you believe your fund size in some ways, everyone in this room knows this, is in some ways your strategy. And so even though KV and FF are roughly the same size, if you think about KV, it's like $500 million in a seed fund, $1.5 billion in a venture fund, and $800 or $900 million in a growth fund. FF is $800 or $900 million or so in venture, seed plus venture, and $3.2 billion in growth. Mm-hmm. So obviously, as someone who does mostly bold, early, I want to be the first institutional investor every time. Like, I don't want to be second. I don't want to be third. I will do those, but it makes me sad when I'm second or third. So there's just different approaches there. FF has been very successful. Brian Singerman, I know, spoke yesterday. Brian is amazing at powering money into companies that are working. Mm-hmm. He may be the best, you know, ever at that. Like he is a master, and FF generally is really, really good at that. At KV, we want to be the first institutional investor and help shape the company from day one.
How would you describe your relationship with them now? Because there was a report in the journal that you had reportedly disagreements with some people there. And obviously, Founders Fund is known for having very strong and contrarian points of view that don't always agree with each other. So was there truth to the report that maybe you were not vibing with some of the people there, or what would be kind of your response?
Well, I think what the future of venture is and how to create alpha in venture, which is important because the distribution of venture returns is mediocre at best. How do you create alpha in venture going in the future is a complicated topic, and people can have very different views about that. I actually think that I have strong views about how to make money in venture. It's worked. I think it will continue to work. You want high ownership, be early, and you want to improve the probabilities of success for founders. That's not for everybody, but that's definitely what I think the future will has been, and it will be the future. And so that's what I want to do with my life.
It's interesting because it is easy to contrast with, for folks who are here both days, Brian Singerman was talking about how board seats, he thinks, can be a waste of time, the worst of both worlds for a VC. And you know, I've obviously talked to the Founders Fund people for many years, and often they say, and I'm sure you know you can say it better than me, but that you know VCs should not be making or breaking the trajectory of a company, and a great founder will succeed with or without a VC. At the same time, I'd say your reputation with your founders is to be very hands-on. So I'm wondering if there is kind of a different philosophy to company building, you know, between.
Well, at KV, we definitely have the philosophy, just speaking on behalf of KV, that we are in the company building business, that we partner with founders, that we want to be the consigliere to the founders, and that we do help improve either the upside potential of the company or the probability of success. And we take that very seriously. It involves a lot of work and stress, actually. There's nothing, you know, obviously FF's been incredibly successful over the years, but like our vision at KV is it is my responsibility to make this company more successful in any way I can. And it varies by founder. Sometimes sitting back and doing nothing is actually making the company more successful. There are founders who are like, all I can do is screw things up. But there's an artistic judgment in knowing that versus when to intercede. Like one of the board meetings, one of the founder meetings I did on Tuesday in SF is a very great company. Like by any standard, it will be a public company without a doubt. It might be one of the best investments of my life. But I did sit down with the founders and say, hey, I think you're doing a couple things that maybe are not ideal. Mm. Let's talk about those. And it was actually a really helpful conversation to them, but to me. And like, really, it wasn't like a vigorous debate. It was more just like, I think you're on the path of least resistance. And that's usually a bad way to make strategic decisions. Like, have you taken a step back? Is this really the company you want to build in this way?
So for founders in the audience, should they welcome their investors disagreeing with them or giving them tough advice, or should they be discounting VCs, generally speaking? What would be your advice to
well, those you companies? Know, I'll channel Vinod. Vinod said there's about five, you know, useful VCs in the world. So maybe there's 10, but I'll let Vinod take credit for that. But I think it depends. There are VCs, like, so I run a company, like I have VCs on my board. They were consciously chosen and prioritized. What they do for me is tell me when I'm wrong. The best thing my VC investors can do is tell me that, hey, Keith, like, I know, you know, X, Y, and Z is working and you've done this before, but you're probably wrong about this, or you should rethink this. And that if that helps me once a year avoid a mistake, incredibly valuable. So it depends on the founder. It depends on the VC. And so there's no one size fits all like answer to that, but I'd be very careful about taking advice from a VC. Like, I took a meeting before this morning. I was brainstorming with a founder over breakfast, and he's been struggling with exact vision of his product. And on the fly, I kind of thought about a combination of two ideas, and I was like, well, have you thought about X? And A, it might resonate better with investors, but that's not a good reason to do this. But B, I actually think it's a better product. And so once in a while, you can help a founder, you know, have an epiphany.
Got it. Let's shift gears a little to your favorite subject, San Francisco.
Oh.
No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
How would you say the ecosystem in Miami has grown over the years you've been there? Because I still see you weighing in pretty heated debates about how big a nucleus there has formed there. And so let's hear the sort of quick Keith defense of the growth there.
Well, just 24 hours, the last 24 hours, Passes announced a $40 million financing in Miami. We announced a KV company that's actually now going to be working out of our office in Miami. So this is literally just like the last 24 hours. Mm-hmm. Two very good investment opportunities for anybody. Look, this is a 10-year journey, and that may have been really scary earlier in my career, like 2000 to 2013. As an entrepreneur, 10 years seems like an eternity. But once you jump over to venture, you're thinking in a decade, time horizon is very natural. So Bill Gurley tweeted when I first moved to Miami that we needed three successful companies that were $10 billion or more. And that's what creates an ecosystem. And I think he's generally right about that. He's like, Chewy counts, so you need two more. And, you know, you can't microwave it. I have this kind of line that's like, you can't really microwave a startup. So you want traction and you want progress. And it's going to take 3 to 5 more years to have $10 billion outcomes. But if we have three or four of them, then the whole ecosystem will be off to the races. Now, one thing that is new and novel is there's a corridor between New York and Miami, which has there always been in finance, you know. Finance people go back and forth all the time seasonally. They've done this for decades, since like the 70s or at least. In tech, this is now happening. So one of the better companies I work with is Ramp. Mm-hmm. Ramp was founded in New York, but we do 3/4 of the board meetings in Miami. 3 of the 4 co-founders, 2 of the 3 official like executive co-founders live on my block in Miami. The company has a major office in Miami, and one of the CTO co-founder lives in Miami full time. So they now go back and forth all of the time. This is becoming a trend. I'm seeing more and more of this.
But that corridor long existed in part for taxes, and because really successful
I don't think it's taxes. It's more weather driven.
Okay, lifestyle. I guess, but like Ramp is an interesting case because most employees are in New York, right?
The majority of the employees are in New York.
And OpenStore, your company, is also hiring in New York, right?
No, I
checked the job listings this morning. At least I saw.
We currently don't have any employees in New York.
Okay. Well, LinkedIn showed a bunch of jobs.
Definitely don't have any in New York. Not that I know about.
I guess we're going to have to check the company profile.
Yeah, yeah. We do have an engineering office in South Bay, but two-thirds to three-quarters of the companies are in my of the employees are
so
in Miami.
So would not have a New York office.
We definitely do not have a New York
office.
I'm
not just jumping the gun on your news.
No. Maybe one day.
Part of why I ask is because, you know, you look at the most notable names who moved to Miami, and of course, there's a survivor bias or whatever there, where they're notable because they're successful. And I think there's a sense like, oh, Miami has maybe been great from a lifestyle standpoint for people who are already later in their career, already really successful, who could run a company remotely like Delian, who you know well, whose company Varda is not based in Miami, right?
Or Howard of Rome.
Yeah. But so I guess my question is, would you still recommend that young people, early career people, be going to Miami too?
Yeah. So, my company, OpenStore, has 127 or 129 employees, like roughly two-thirds, maybe a little more, are in Miami. The median age is got to be 28. So it's not people who have been successful. Like I'm like double the median age of probably the company or something. And then I keep meeting really interesting founders like that are somewhere between 24 and 35 in Miami. Mm. Humans are humans. Like Miami is the happiest and healthiest city in America. Like there's like all these third parties that study this every year. And entrepreneurs want to be happy and healthy, or they should. And so if you want to be happy, healthy, and professionally ambitious, you can now do that in Miami, in tech. You could always do it in finance. And so I run into and meet really interesting people in Miami. Like actually, a data point I used recently is of the 20 people that are closest to me in life, 16 or 15 live in Miami. Mm. Now, I moved them. I mean, some of them I actually literally like was like Noah's Ark. I was like, you're moving to Miami. But like some of them I met for the first time, obviously. Okay.
Did they have a choice, or you just kind of loaded them up, untie them? When they got them?
Yeah. Well, we have like a 13th or 14th Amendment against indentured servitude, so yeah, it was voluntary.
Got it. I was in San Francisco last week, and of course, there's so much energy around the AI community there, and a founder there who I met had lived in LA during the pandemic, moved back to San Francisco, and what they said to me was, and I'm a New Yorker, so I have my own biases. I love New York, and they said, Alex, New York, Miami, these other cities are trying to make it plausibly acceptable and not a red flag that a founder can live here and have a better lifestyle. But if you were just purely focused on your company, no social life, no personal life, the most efficient, best place to be would still be San Francisco. And these other cities are trying to basically create an excuse to not be there.
So let me give you two critiques to that. One is, have you heard of Shopify?
I have.
One of the most impressive companies over the last 15 years, definitely Ottawa. Would you have said like, oh, you're ambitious and that's where you start a company? We were talking backstage about Trade Republic in Berlin, which will absolutely be more valuable than Robinhood in Berlin. Founder had never spent any time in the Bay Area. So like you're in Nubank. Now one of the founders had spent some time in the Bay Area, but still, these are all like the most, three quarters of the most impressive companies over the last decade other than OpenAI. And so they're not in the Bay Area.
Okay.
And then if you think about Anduril, not in the Bay Area. Like, name the top 10 companies of the last decade and where are they based? You can find a couple in the Bay Area, not a majority.
There is that one OpenAI that people seem to care about a lot.
That's true. Well, we invested in it at KV. So, all the evidence is the exact opposite. Secondly, though, on an ambitious person, where should they be? There's pros and cons to being in a monoculture. So there are some things you learn. Like a network effect has positives, but a network effect also has negatives, and I think sometimes people miss that. So for example, the one person cited in that Wall Street Journal article who actually literally moved from Miami back to SF is a founder I invested in, a friend of mine. I get $1 million investment, seed investment, and somehow became a Wall Street Journal story. But anyway, he moved back. He had worked at Apple, came to Miami to work at OpenStore, and then started an AI-based company and moved back against my better judgment. So 3 months in, I was like, hey, his name's Sam. I was like, what do you think? And he's like, everything you said about SF is true. Now, that said, he is an AI-based company. They pivoted. Maybe it makes sense for them to be there. But the fact that he agreed after living 3 to 4 months in the Bay Area, he's like, I haven't met any really ambitious people. Like, this is all a myth. Like, there's a lot of reality distortion. New York's a great place for ambitious people, actually. It has been forever. If you were a top-tier lawyer, management consultant, iBanker, you didn't...
All jobs did not want.
Yeah, so. Well, I don't want... I was a lawyer. I got out of law. I was, smart enough. But fundamentally, people work really hard in New York. Like, my friend Mike's company, Traba, did start in Miami and has now a majority of employees in New York. And one of the reasons why is they have a 9-9-6 culture where they literally work at least 9-9-6, like 9 to 9 and 6 days a week. And it's been easier to find people who's that's their DNA in New York, much easier in New York than in SF. People do not work 9-9-6 in SF. Like I can name all the people probably working 9-9-6 like in an office in SF.
Okay. quickly, if you could not pick Miami, what city would you be setting down roots in today?
Stockholm, maybe?
Stockholm.
Tel Aviv, maybe. But Stockholm is very impressive. I had not really spent any time there, and Crandon, they had their 20th anniversary, and they invited me to speak, so I spent a few days out there. And there's a wonderful entrepreneurial scene. They've had like lots of success. They have a zero capital gains tax, which is very attractive to me, which I didn't know. It's actually really an interesting policy decision. High income tax, zero capital gains. So what that does is it motivates anybody with talent to take risk, which is actually a really healthy societal trend. It may be not accidental that they've had a lot of entrepreneurs. I happen to be, my vice in life is EDM music. It's a great music scene. It's on the water like Miami, which is, I think, very good for people. So if I now understand why my friend and former partner at FF, Kenny Howery, wanted to be ambassador to Sweden. At first, I didn't understand why he chose that country of all the countries. Now I'm like, God, Kenny's brilliant.
All right, well, any Swedish founders are going to...
Oh, they should have. Yeah, no, a few have reached out.
There you go. Also, quickly, I wanted to touch on how you've built your brand, because when I speak to founders who work with you, they say, oh, Keith is so much nicer in person than he is on Twitter. Why do they say that? Why would you want people to think you're a jerk on Twitter?
Well, I had this dumb idea a decade ago, and maybe I should rethink it, of like trying to correct everything that's wrong on the internet, which is really a fool's errand. Yeah. Unfortunately, there's a lot of dumb things on the internet, and it could be like time consuming too. But if you think about it, all the content you see on Twitter is not representative of a normal day. Like the people I work with, first of all, the founders I work with are not a normal distribution of people. So they're mostly right. So all I do all day is nod my head mostly. Mm. And then once in a while, like probe and ask a few questions. So like it's an unrepresentative sample. And then B, it's an unrepresentative sample on the positive side of who I get to work with. The founders you all interviewed for your story, they're all world-class founders. And they're incredibly smart, talented, ambitious.
Yeah, but they say they try to avoid your tweets because you're retweeting Charlie Kirk and you're fighting with people, and this is not how they want to spend their day.
Well, they some do, some don't. they want me to tweet on behalf of their company, though, usually.
Okay. Well, for people in the audience, would you recommend controversy and being outspoken on social media is a good way to, you know, get recognition and build your brand? Would you do that all over again?
If it's authentic, I think that it can be very good. If it's not authentic, it's a terrible idea. And then the other reason for me personally was, as a venture capitalist, it's easier than running a company. And now I'm doing both, which is complicated. When you run a company, you represent a wide, diverse set of people. When you're venture firms are small and you don't, you know, you may even have your own brand. It's a very different calculation. So I would rethink it if I was just going to be a CEO. Secondly, though, I did wake up one day in like 2015 and said, I've got a lot of followers on Twitter. With the Jeff Bezos regret framework, if I can proselytize on any topic that's important to me or my family and have impact, I don't want to wake up in 30 or 40 years and think that I could have shaped somebody's opinion and improve society. So I have a lot of followers, and therefore occasionally it has impact and influence. And that is really valuable to me on like political topics sometimes, on policy topics sometimes, on technology topics. Like, for example, you know, I was this vigorous critic of the lean startup movement. I still think it's intellectually bankrupt and stupid. And if I save 5 founders on the planet from following this bankrupt philosophy, maybe I've just changed their life.
Well, I would love to pull Mark Benioff from last year here and filibuster for another 30 minutes. there's so much more I would have loved to talk about, like OpenStore, the Thrasio bankruptcy. So you are on Twitter, so maybe the audience can hit us up after this for all the stuff we didn't cover. But thank you so much for the insights today, Keith.
Pleasure.